Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. I'm Chris Tidwell.
And I'm Richard Dean Winfield.
Today's topic, our topic for today, has to do with nuclear disarmament and proliferation of nuclear weapons, the history around that, and then, of course, where to go from here. America has a unique position on this topic, given that we are the first and largest nuclear power. The justification for our stockpiling of these weapons was once justified by war, and now this stockpile has grown to a world-ending magnitude, which theoretically is in the name of general national security. The basic argument is that the U.S. maintains a certain nuclear strength. It will deter other militaries from taking direct action on us, hence the name deterrence. So we have sort of a Cold War where no one dares infringe on the nuclear powers of the world, specifically the United States. But is this big stick security really all that simple? Are we really forced to go back to this world, this natural competition where those who have the most powerful weapon are the safest? Richard, could you shed light on your thinking around this issue, and particularly in context of what security means and looks like, given the sort of follow-up that we could have from last week's episode discussing security and climate change?
Yeah. Now my thoughts about how our security, our national security, is intrinsically connected to global security is something that has been hitting us in the face and hitting me in the face in light of our vulnerability to the coronavirus, where we're obviously dealing with something that is a pandemic and where the condition of health in other nations has a direct impact on our own health and, moreover, on our economic welfare. The same thing obviously applies also with regard to all of the growing threats to our welfare that our looming climate crisis presents to us, where once again, the impact of climate change on our national security is something that cannot be separated on its impact upon global security, particularly since efforts to mitigate climate change cannot simply be taken in one country. Obviously, in this case, if there's to be any way of meeting the crisis, it has to be done through international effort on a major, vast scale. Now, the implications for this kind of interconnectedness regarding military security and specifically with regarding both conventional and nuclear arms was really brought to my attention in one of my fortuitous call time conversations, where, as I mentioned in our last podcast, I had ended up calling a retired professor from Stanford University, Martin Hellman, who was instrumental in drafting a document called Rethinking National Security, which then made the rounds among high officials in our diplomatic corps and our military establishment, and generated, I think, quite a lot of interest and concern. And I want to have us follow the main points of that discussion, which I think really put before us all sorts of quandaries we face, given the kind of strategy we have pursued, both with regard to the role of conventional weaponry and nuclear weaponry in regard to our national security. Now, one thing that those who had reflected on this document were struck by is the following situation that I think is pretty undeniable. That is, you know, when World War II ended in 1945, You know, you could say that the United States was in a position of tremendous national security in that we had destroyed the Nazi menace. The Soviet Union was suffering from vast war losses in terms of the destruction of its industrial bases, 20 million casualties. And on top of that, we were, of course, separated by oceans, which had allowed at least our continental territories to have not suffered any of the kind of destruction that vast areas of the world had suffered. But we also had a nuclear monopoly. And at that time, it could be said that we were completely secure from any kind of attack. You know, we had a kind of inviolability. But then what happened? What has happened in the years since then? In the 75 years since then, you know, we have spent trillions and trillions of dollars on both conventional and nuclear arms. We spend by far more money and have spent by far more money on our defense establishment than any nation, and indeed more than the next five or six nations combined. You know, we have, of course, a global military infrastructure with more than 800 bases overseas, where the rest of the world has no more than 60 bases overseas. And yet, what is the state of our security? Well, the absurd situation is that despite all of this vast defense infrastructure, all these trillions of dollars that we have spent, we can be totally destroyed in less than an hour by the nuclear weapons of our adversaries. Now, we need to really rethink our national security. And Hellman is suggesting that we take into account, in particular, the inseparability of national and global security. And this is becoming ever more apparent when you think not only of nuclear weapons, but other weapons of mass destruction, such as chemical and biological weapons, but also cyber warfare, the threat of terrorism, and of course, environmental crises. And to get a sense of the kind of interconnection that we have to think about, both with regard to nuclear weaponry and conventional weaponry, is sort of the lessons that are presented to us by the examples of Libya on the one hand and North Korea and Iran on the other. You may remember that around 2003, Libya gave up its nuclear weapons program. You know, it was moving along, it had reactors, it was refining nuclear fuel and so forth. It had obtained information from the Khan group in Pakistan, which would enable it to be able to go ahead and make use of workable designs for weaponry. But George W. Bush offered a deal to Gaddafi that if he gave up his nuclear weapons program, Libya would, in a sense, be guaranteed a secure and respected place among nations. Sanctions would be lifted. Gaddafi would not have to worry about regime change. But as we all know, as the Arab Spring gathered steam, Gaddafi faced an insurrection, and at a certain point, the United States gave its help in a decisive way to some of the insurgents, leading to the fall of Gaddafi's regime and his execution at the hand of insurgents. Now, this, in a way, presented a lesson to the leaders of both North Korea and Iran, because it showed them that to the extent that the United States and other powers were challenging their legitimacy, threatening the viability of their regime through both severe economic sanctions and the threat of military action to topple the regime, this indicated to them that their security could only be achieved by developing nuclear weapons. And what that meant is that to the extent that we were pursuing our own interests and not thinking from the point of view of the Iranian regime or the North Korean regime, we, to a large degree, pushed them into the one path that seemed to be a way of guaranteeing their own security, which is to say, to go nuclear. Now, of course, in doing that, we did not enhance our own security. Rather, in the case of North Korea, we have a regime that did go ahead and eventually developed and tested nuclear weapons, a regime that has delivery vehicles that can hit the United States, a regime that now has an arsenal of sufficient nuclear weapons to destroy a good number of American cities. You can't say that our security has been enhanced by what has happened. And in a way, you could draw a lesson from this. And if you want to present it as a particular principle, it would sort of go as follows, that if we really want to avoid other nations developing nuclear weapons, that is, nations that do not already have them, which obviously pose a much greater threat to our security than they do without nuclear weapons, then we need to treat them with the kind of respect we would offer them if they had nuclear weapons, and to offer them that respect beforehand, so that we do not push them into a position where they find their security so threatened that they can only take the route of developing nuclear weapons. And this also would apply to other kinds of destructive weapon systems, biological weapons, chemical weapons, cyber technologies that can be extremely destructive. The same principle could be said to apply. We don't want to be in a position where we are threatening other nations to a degree where they see as their only resort or as their last resort to protect themselves and their regime is to arm themselves with the kind of weaponry that puts our security in a much weaker position.
This is interesting because it's sort of like an anticipatory harmony, or such that a nation has to decide that they would like to be in peace and they have to take the step first. Because oftentimes these debates around who's to have the nukes comes down to who's going to put their gun down first game. And the idea there is oftentimes the U.S. will continue to try and leverage other nations to, quote, put, I guess, the gun down, or in the analogy, while in fact they're the one that's threatening with all the power. So it would make a lot of sense that instead they just say they are the United States would be the ones to try and back off from an engagement, so that therefore there's less. It's kind of the inverse of deterrence. It's like, well, if we don't even bring a gun to the table, then there will be no gun that will fight back. Am I getting that right, or is it?
Well, there's sort of this. There's been this prevalent view, particularly on the side of, I guess you could say, those who have designed our weapons programs and decided our defense policies. And that is the view that by having nuclear and conventional weapon superiority, we have been able to keep the peace and keep ourselves secure. Now, admittedly, there has not been a nuclear war since World War II, which was the world's one and only nuclear war so far. And of course, the United States is the only nation that has used nuclear weapons in warfare. Truman, after Roosevelt's death, went ahead and bombed Hiroshima. And he himself authorized that. Not long after, as we all know, Nagasaki was bombed. Truman was surprised that had taken place. He had not authorized that particular bombing. But in a way, this raises a problem we'll discuss in a moment. That is the way in which having the authority to use nuclear weapons is something distinct from having the ability to use them. It turned out that the Army was able to go ahead and drop another bomb on Nagasaki. And at that point, Truman told them, I don't want any more weapons dropped at all. No more atomic weaponry will be used. But, you know, one thing that one could say is fine. There hasn't been any other nuclear exchange since the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki. And there hasn't been a world war since World War II. We managed not to engage in a hot war with the Soviet Union. The Cold War went on, right? There were all sorts of armed conflicts going on in which the different sides could be said to be representative of the two great adversarial world powers. But there wasn't an actual hot war directly between the United States and the USSR. Now, of course, one could point out that even if we have so far avoided nuclear destruction, that doesn't mean that we can expect that situation to remain the same, because it's quite obvious that there can be miscalculations on either side. There can be mistakes. There can be mishaps. And you may not be old enough to remember this, but you know, I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, and I was there when the Cuban Missile Crisis took place. Before then, I had been in public schools in Queens, and we would have regular drills where we would go down to a kind of nuclear shelter, basically go downstairs into the basement of the school as if that would protect us from a nuclear weapon. It. Of course, there were all sorts of articles in the press about how the Soviets had developed, they'd exploded a 100-megaton weapon. They had in their arsenal 50-megaton weapons that would incinerate everything within 100 miles or more of the center of New York City. So all of this was quite ridiculous. But the Cuban Missile Crisis came, and it was quite clear that the entire world was really on the very edge of a full-scale nuclear exchange, whose consequences are terrifying to think about, and I'll have more to say about what those consequences would be. But, you know, there have been certain instances where there have been sort of breakdowns in the kind of equipment that was supposed to be letting either the Soviet Union or the United States know that an attack was incoming of nuclear missiles. Recently, there was word of, after the fall of the Soviet Union and the opening up of their archives, that there had been an incident where all of the sort of systems for tracking a potential nuclear attack were registering an incoming attack coming into the Soviet Union. And one commander who had under his jurisdiction a whole battery of nuclear-armed missiles was being instructed to set them off, and he refused to do it, even though all these indicators were that an attack was imminent. And he, in effect, saved the world. His name has come out. I forget what it is. There have been other incidents where, you know, the United States has lost nuclear weapons. In 2007, as recently as 2007, our Air Force lost 6 nuclear weapons for 36 hours. So it's not as if everything is so secure. It's not as if we can say that our past ability to keep the peace is something that will continue. And one thing that you have to keep in mind in all of this is to ask yourself, well, how many nuclear weapons do we really need to be able to deter an adversary from attacking us? Mm. And with what certainty do they have to have the ability to penetrate our defenses? For example, if North Korea, a relatively poor nation, which managed to develop nuclear weapons and has a small stockpile, if it has a 50% chance of striking a major U.S. city with one weapon, is that a sufficient deterrent? And if we have a nuclear arsenal far greater than what is needed for deterrence, does that enhance or diminish our security? Well, in a certain sense, it's quite obvious. It terrifically diminishes our security, because what might happen. We might have a full-scale exchange where in exchange for what might be spoken of as a relative defeat, we end up obliterating all of humanity. Now, today, when you think of the threats of nuclear weaponry, you know, the end of the Cold War has made people focus more on terrorist threats, right? One worries not so much about an exchange between the huge remaining arsenals of Russia and the United States, or even between the much smaller arsenal of China and the United States, or the much smaller arsenal yet of North Korea and the United States. People think more of, well, what would happen if a terrorist group could get control of one of these suitcase atom bombs, bring it to New York City. You know, one could kill tens of thousands, if not 100,000 people. I mean, is that our real security threat? Or is the security threat a nuclear war with Russia, where a billion or more people might be killed? That is, casualties that are 10,000 times as great as in any terrorist attack. And then consequences that might threaten the very existence of humanity. Now, we have to keep in mind that we have had, as part of our nuclear strategy, you know, we had a NATO organization where the nations in NATO were under the American nuclear umbrella. Britain and France also have their own nuclear weapons, but it was primarily the American nuclear weaponry that served as an umbrella that was supposed to deter the Soviet Union, which had much more powerful land forces in close proximity to Western European nations. And you might say that, well, this had kept the peace. But on the other hand, you might ask yourself, does that nuclear shield that we're offering enhance security or actually undermine our security? And one case in point that you might think about is very recently, you know, Turkey shot down, this is 2015, a Russian jet in Syria. You know, where Russia has, of course, been aiding the Sadat regime. Turkey has been siding with certain Islamists in parts of Syria that are near the Turkish border. Well, Turkey could get away with this because it could feel protected by NATO guarantees. But are we really enhancing security by doing this? Are we not actually, in a sense, emboldening our allies to engage in activities that really could put ourselves in jeopardy? And there was a time when the whole idea of NATO expanding itself and going towards the borders of Russia, you know, was very much questioned by people in the American defense establishment. You know, William Perry, who was Secretary of Defense at the time when this expansion was being considered, you know, regarded the expansion as not serving our security because it was threatening Russia. And you have Article 5 of the NATO agreement, which basically says that an attack on one member is an attack on all. Well, do we really want to find ourselves in that situation where an attack that might lead to harm to a particular nation, maybe even occupation by Soviet army, or more recently, the Russian army, whether that would be worth preventing in exchange for a full-scale nuclear exchange that really could completely wipe out ourselves and much, if not all, of humanity. Now, note that you can see similar kinds of problems regarding conventional superiority. You know, does the fact that we have a conventional weapon superiority really give us more security? Or is it the opposite the case? During the 1999 Kosovo crisis, where Serbia was engaged in a war with Kosovo, engaging in ethnic cleansing and the like, and Clinton had the United States ready to intervene, Well, a British general who was on the ground was unwilling to follow the orders of the American general who was supposedly in operational control of the Allied troops that were in that area to protect Kosovo, because he did not want to get into any kind of armed conflict with Russian troops. Clark felt that, look, we had conventional superiority. We could defeat anything the Russians did. And Clark felt confident that the Russians would back down. But do you want to risk nuclear war based on conventional superiority? This was, in a sense, the inverse of the situation in Western Europe under the Cold War, where the land army of the Soviet Union was superior in its armaments to the conventional army of NATO. And for that reason, NATO had to rely upon a nuclear deterrent. Well, in a sense, that gives you an inkling of how conventional superiority can put your own security in jeopardy, because it encourages the other side to both develop nuclear weapons as well as to target you with nuclear weapons to prevent your conventional superiority from undermining their own security. So we see that, you know, there are two problems. There's a problem of, first of all, arming yourself to the teeth with nuclear weapons, and also the problem of remaining the sole conventional superpower in a nuclear age. Because when you do that, whether intentionally or unintentionally, you're encouraging nuclear proliferation, and you may also be encouraging other countries that already have nuclear weapons to feel that they have to be more ready to use them.
Right. And then there's also the problem, I guess, maybe lesser, I suppose, but there's this problem of stockpiling in general, where it can backfire literally. Or also I see that there's this problem of authorization as well. I mean, who do we give the keys to the nuke? Who gets to decide? I mean, obviously it has to be somewhat of a quick decision if it does happen, but that's almost impossible to actually pull off without being somewhat shaky on the actual activation point. So there's that question of stockpiling and question of authorization. And then there's also, as you've already said, this problem of retaliation.
Yeah, I mean, think of the big quandary of the whole idea of what's called MAD, you know, mutual assured destruction as a deterrent, where basically we have the situation under which I lived under my youth, as much of humanity, when the United States faced the Soviet Union. Each side had vast armaments of huge stockpiles and huge deployments of nuclear warheads. And the idea that both parties were following was that they could deter any attack upon themselves, because each side would know that if they attacked their opponent, that opponent would wipe them off the face of the earth with a counterattack. And yet, you know, if you think about that strategy, you want to ask yourself, well, what do you do when you're being attacked? I mean, what's the point of counterattacking? After all, you're already going to be obliterated. Why go ahead and obliterate the other side? What is that going to do? And moreover, as we'll see in a moment, being subject to an attack is something that will have implications for intelligent life on the planet as a whole. So you have to ask yourself, well, I mean, are we to think of our adversaries as being rational people, or should we think of them, and do we want them to think of us as being completely irrational and vindictive? And this then also raises the question of, well, do we really want anyone to have a nuclear button? I don't want Donald Trump to have his finger on a button whereby he can unilaterally launch an attack on Russia of a magnitude that will not only cause hundreds of millions of people to die, but will incite a counterattack that, together with our attack, could wipe off humanity off the face of the earth for reasons we'll get into. Now, ordinarily, right, we have the idea that, according to our Constitution, no acts of war should be engaged in unless there is a declaration of war, which Congress has supported. You know, the Senate must be get involved. But in a nuclear war, in a nuclear situation, a nuclear world, where both sides have the ability to destroy the other side within as little as 15 minutes, maybe at most half an hour or an hour, it doesn't seem that you have time. You have time to be able to make use of any kind of congressional authorization. And then there's the other side of it. Well, I mean, then do you just have it be the president? Well, can it just be the president? I don't know if you've seen the film Dr. Strangelove, yeah, which I think everyone should see. And actually, I think it should be part of our school curriculum.
Yeah, I watched it in a high school history class, actually.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Well, you may remember that there's this U.S. Air Force general, a rogue general, played by Sterling Hayden, who orders his nuclear-armed bomber wing to attack the Soviet Union. And he just does it unilaterally. And once there's word of this happening, it's too late for other forces to get on the base and stop it. And when the American leadership calls in the Soviet leadership to tell them what's going on, the president, who's played by Peter Sellers, who also plays Dr. Strangelove and a British general on the base where Sterling Hayden is doing his thing, the president says, you know, I was under the impression that I was the only one in authority to launch a nuclear strike. And he's told by one of his assistants that, well, indeed, you are the only one with the authority to launch a nuclear strike. But the ability to do so is possessed by others further down the chain of command. As indeed, you know, it sort of can't help but be. I remember one of my graduate students when I first came to the University of Georgia was someone who worked in a nuclear submarine that was armed to the teeth with nuclear-armed missiles. And they were in a position where they, in effect, could launch a devastating attack.
Wow.
And of course, one was not supposed to discuss all that much about it. Now, you might ask, well, why was it that you had an ability further down the chain of command to be able to launch attacks? Well, as the president in Dr. Strangelove is told, well, we had to discourage the Ruskies from any hope that they could knock you out and escape retaliation. Indeed, there's this threat of a decapitation strike where a nuclear weapon could obliterate the leadership of a country. And if only that leadership had the power to launch a counterattack, deterrence would not be very strong. In fact, there'd be an invitation to engage in a decapitating strike and then be able to wipe off an enemy without any worry. So in a sense, this whole logic of mutual destruction put us in a very precarious position, puts us in a very precarious position. And given the short flight times of ballistic missiles, it's really impossible to adhere to our constitutional requirement that Congress declare war. A nuclear war is not going to operate like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we really have to think of what is our situation today. You know, in 1945, we had a nuclear monopoly. We were separated from our adversaries by huge oceans. And yet we engaged in this vast expansion of military, particularly our nuclear weaponry. And now we find ourselves in a situation where we can be totally destroyed in less than an hour.
So with this, I mean, truly existential threat, surprisingly very similar to the potentials of climate change, where it seems to be there's no gain to be had from a state except a loss if some kind of nuclear warhead was shot off at one of our adversaries. In what ways can we say we're going to be the first one to back off? And why is this something that doesn't have, I guess, exactly a clear pass through? Why can we not? Why can we not get over this? Put the gun down, so to speak.
Yeah. Well. First of all, there are some examples of things that might lead us to think maybe there is a way out. You know, the high tide of nuclear armament was reached in 1986. These are the very last years of the Soviet Union, when Gorbachev had entered the scene, and weaponry would then begin to be reduced. You had 70,300 active warheads in the world. In 2019, the total of active warheads is 13,865. So there's been a sharp decrease. And keep in mind that 90% of the armed nuclear weapons that are in the world today are possessed by Russia and the United States. We have built a total of 70,000, more than any other nation. We had a high in 1966 of 31,175 warheads. The USSR had in 1986 45,000 warheads. They have built a total of 55,000. Now, when we speak about this large drop in numbers, keep in mind that many of these decommissioned weapons have not been destroyed. They've either been stored and their triggering mechanisms may have been detached, or they're partially dismantled. But it's not as if they have disappeared entirely from the scene. Now, if you want to just keep in perspective, who has these nuclear weapons? Where did they get them? And then to think about what has happened since their acquisition that could give us a sense of how we get out of this predicament. Keep in mind, we became the first nuclear power in 1945. Today, we have 1,750 deployed nuclear weapons. We have a total of between 5,800 and 6,185 total weapons. 150 of them, by the way, are in NATO states, under presumably U.S. control. We developed the first atom bomb in 1945. We developed the first hydrogen bomb in 1952. The USSR became the second nuclear power in 1949. It today has slightly less deployed nuclear weapons than we do, 1,572. They have a total number that's comparable to ours, maybe slightly more, between 6,300 and 6,400. They developed a hydrogen bomb in 1955. The United Kingdom came third in 1952. They have 120 warheads deployed, a total of between 200 and 215. They developed a hydrogen bomb in 1957. France developed its bomb in 1960, a hydrogen bomb in 1968. They have 280 nuclear weapons deployed out of a total of 290. China then became a nuclear power in 1964. There aren't obvious figures about how many are deployed. They have a total of 300 to 320 nuclear weapons. Note, far, far fewer than either the USA or the US, or Russia, I should say. Israel became a nuclear power probably in 1966. You know, they've never admitted to it. It's estimated that they have 90 total nuclear weapons. India exploded an atomic bomb in 1974 and developed a hydrogen bomb in 1998. They are believed to have 140 to 150 nuclear weapons total. Pakistan developed its nuclear weapon or exploded its nuclear weapon in 1998. They have 160 nuclear bombs. North Korea detonated its nuclear weapon in 2006. They are thought to have 30 to 40 nuclear warheads. They claim to have developed a hydrogen bomb in 2017. There's some controversy about that. Now, that is where we stand today. That is the inventory today. And it is a frightening inventory for reasons we're going to get into. But on the other hand, not only has there been a sizable reduction in the total of warheads, but there have been countries that have completely given up nuclear weapons. Not many people knew that the Union of South Africa had developed nuclear weapons. They had produced six nuclear bombs. they were dismantled, and they ended their nuclear pattern, their program at the very end of the apartheid regime before it made its transition to a more democratic state under Nelson Mandela. Then you had something that happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Three nations, or I should say three parts of the erstwhile Soviet Union, became independent nations. And they had in their territory huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons. Belarus had 81 nuclear weapons. Kazakhstan had 1,400 nuclear weapons. Ukraine had 3,000 nuclear weapons, making it really the number three nuclear power in the world. All of these nations decided to give their weapons back to Russia. Now, they did it with a pledge on the part of Russia to respect their borders. Now, we know that that pledge was not honored in regard to Ukraine, because in 2014, Russia annexed Crimea, and it's also been supporting this this war in eastern Ukraine by Russian nationals who are trying to detach a part of Ukraine. But in any event, you had countries that gave up nuclear weapons. You also had the Iran nuclear weapons deal in 2015, where basically Iran more or less agreed to put a hold on its development of nuclear weapons. And this involved, you know, wide-ranging suspensions of its activity with very, very extensive very extensive inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency. But and the Atomic Energy indicated agency through its inspections indicated that Iran was complying. But then Trump decided to have us withdraw from the withdrawal. He reimposes sanctions, whose lifting was part of a deal with Iran to stop its nuclear development program. And then after the U.S. killed General Soleimani, Iran declared that it was no longer going to abide by the deal. But that's sort of a part of the situation we see, where there have been agreements, there have been nations who have given up. And to put this in perspective, I think it's important to think about what is the danger we face? What is the danger we face of a nuclear holocaust?
Well, we've seen it in plenty of popular culture. It seems to be one of the only imaginable options in the future. But besides that, there's a constant imminent fear of people losing their livelihood, their life, their jobs, their kids to things that, I would say are smaller than this, but I'm honestly sometimes more comprehensible than this, than nuclear holocaust, that is. So one of the difficulties at the same time of it being a popular culture icon, it also seems distant, kind of in the same way that climate change does. It seems to be something that the state's supposed to worry about, and it's not something a voter always has on the tip of their mind. So maybe not just paint us a picture, but situate it in this world.
Well, let me just give you a sense of what we are facing, because we're still facing the threat of a nuclear holocaust. Because we, the United States, have deployed, you know, somewhat under 2,000 weapons, and the Russians have done the same. And if we were to exchange weapons with one another, if for any reason whatsoever, any miscalculation, any mistake, any mishap, there were to be a sizable launch of nuclear weapons, we have to consider what would happen. There was a very popular bestseller by a writer named Neville Shute. It was called On the Beach. And it tried to discuss, to sort of present, like many books and films of the day in the 50s and 60s, what a nuclear holocaust might be like. And in this case, it gave us a relatively benign image where Essentially, the nuclear exchange took place in the Northern Hemisphere. And of course, that obliterated much of the population. But then you had the Southern Hemisphere, which was not directly attacked. And much of the novel, and there was a kind of evocative film by Stanley Kramer on the beach, had to do with people in Australia who did not suffer any atomic bombing, but they're going to be facing death by radiation because the clouds of radiation produced by the atomic explosions are ultimately going to come their way, and there is no way in which anyone can escape it. Well, this is in a way a kind of benign, peaceful way of portraying what would happen. And subsequent research has shown that what we can expect is something of a different character. To begin with, you know, in that portrayal down in Australia and down on all of the Southern Hemisphere, life is going on pretty much normally. But, you know, if you had just one bomb detonated in the atmosphere, detonated high above the USA, for example, or in the Southern Hemisphere, this would wipe out solid-state electrical circuits throughout these territories. If 10,000 megatons were detonated, and that is much less than a full-fledged exchange between Russia and the United States, 70% of the ozone in the Northern Hemisphere would be destroyed, and 40% in the Southern Hemisphere. And that would immediately harm plant and animal life, because the ozone protects us against ultraviolet light, and now we would be wide open. And one of the things that has allowed life to evolve on this planet is the ozone layer. And that would be fatally damaged by a nuclear exchange. And then there is something that goes by the name of nuclear winter. And this would be due to the fact that atomic explosions, which will incinerate cities and produce gigantic clouds of smoke, would obstruct sunlight from penetrating the Earth. Now, of course, this is sort of the reverse of global warming. You know, in global warming, you have these greenhouse gases that allow in sunlight, but don't allow the heat to radiate out into space. Here, by contrast, you have clouds of debris that are calculated would sink temperatures in the center of continents to 23 degrees below zero. That's Fahrenheit. Which would really obliterate pretty much all life in those territories. And there would be extremely violent storms due to the difference in temperature between the interior of continents and the coastlines, which would be somewhat more moderate. And even if only 100 megatons were dropped, which could be a matter of 10 weapons, 15 weapons, less than 1% of the world arsenal, this would produce a drop of 50 degrees Fahrenheit throughout the planet. Again, killing most land plants, damaging all. And in the ocean, the darkness on the planet would largely shut down algae photosynthesis, which is really at the base of all marine food chains. So it would have devastating consequences for life in the oceans. Now that in a way is something that we're facing, and therefore, you know, if we understand all the risks we are facing, it seems we have to think about nuclear disarmament. And yet, it seems that nuclear disarmament is something that cannot be done, because it appears, on the one hand, that in order to have genuine nuclear disarmament and have it be done effectively and ensure that no one is cheating and no one develops them again, etc., that we need a global state that can enforce nuclear disarmament everywhere. And as long as we have sovereign nations, we don't have a world government that can do that. But then on the other hand, the world situation precludes the establishment of a world government. So it might appear we have an impasse. It's interesting to see what has been done so far. At times where there have been efforts made to move towards nuclear disarmament. And one very important effort is something that took place when the United States had a nuclear monopoly. You know, when we were the only ones with nuclear weapons, And of course, you might ask yourself, what would the world be like if Nazi Germany was the one nation that had a nuclear monopoly? Or ultimately, what would the world be like if Stalin was the one world leader who had nuclear weapons at his disposal? Would they use them in a way to really impose their will on other nations or not? Well, the United States actually acted quite differently. And I think the history of this is important to take note of, also in terms of where we can go from here. I doubt it's anything that you encountered in your history classes.
As in the history of nuclear disarmament, or
yeah, in other words, of what happened when the United States actually attempted to bring about nuclear disarmament while it still had a monopoly on the bomb.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not something that you go over typically.
I mean, I certainly never learned about it. But in 1946, our Secretary of State, his name was James Burns, mm-hmm. he set up a committee, which was headed by Dean Acheson, and it had as its consultants the very well-known nuclear physicists who played a big role in the Manhattan Project, David Lilienthal and Robert Oppenheimer. They came up with a report to propose a way of achieving nuclear disarmament. And what they suggested is that all nuclear activities be put under international control. That is, all nuclear power generation, all matters of producing nuclear fuel, of doing things to enrich uranium or plutonium or anything like that, all of that should be put under international control. Why? To avoid the problem of having to inspect large numbers of independent national nuclear facilities and dealing with all the obstacles that independent nations might be doing. In this way, all potentially dangerous nuclear activities would be placed under the direct control and, you might say, ownership of an international authority that basically was associated with the UN. Now, that was the plan that was put forward by Oppenheimer and Lilienthal. Now, this was a plan that was criticized by Bernard Baruch, who was appointed by Truman to represent the United States at United Nations disarmament talks, which were being instituted to deal with the possibility of getting rid of nuclear weapons once and for all. What Baruch questioned was the problem of the Security Council, because the plan in question would be one where if anyone was violating the strictures of this plan of putting all nuclear activities under international control, this would be something that would come before the United Nations Security Council. But there is a veto in the Security Council, and the Soviet Union in particular can wield that veto to nullify the decisions, so that any of the nations on the Security Council, and it turns out the five permanent members ended up being the five recognized nuclear powers, the United States, what's today Russia, what's today China, France, and the United Kingdom, they all became nuclear powers. Well, they could veto and nullify any decisions having to do with how this United Nations control of nuclear development would take place. So Baruch recommended that the veto power of the Security Council be abolished for any decisions having to do with atomic energy. And he also recommended very strict penalties for violations. And that the Security Council would then be in a position to adopt a very strong role. And Truman adopted Baruch's recommendations. Well, this was presented to the United Nations, and the Soviet Union rejected it. Now, why did the Soviet Union reject it? Well, the Soviet Union did not want to have its veto nullified. It didn't want to, in a way, allow the United Nations, in which the United States had a large degree of influence, to be able to control what was happening with Soviet nuclear energy. And Gromyko, who was the Soviet foreign minister, or I should say he was their representative at the UN, He also denounced the inspections that would be undertaken as being a violation of national sovereignty. So what did Gromyko propose as an alternative? He wanted basically the United States to give up our nuclear monopoly and then engage in discussions with the Soviet Union to discuss inspection and international controls to prevent any further nuclear weapons. This was rejected by the United States. Why? Well, it seemed like we were giving up everything without getting any confirmation in return. And of course, the Soviet Union was involved in developing nuclear weapons, which they would then begin producing in a new arms race that you could say began in 1949.
And so it seems that once again we sort of have this problem of the impasse, that one country doesn't want to give the technology that they have to other countries, and then some countries don't want to give up their sovereignty, the control over their nation. So in order to internationalize nuclear weapons and the sort, the great frustration of this is ultimately it would be for a greater good, but everybody is sort of atomized into their own country. And it's surprising, I guess, at one level, because the Americans were the ones to try and come up with this, that there needs to be some sort of coalescence of government to try and face the challenges of nuclear disarmament. But largely, I mean, this is faded. I mean, almost in every respect of the fight to maybe internationalize some sort of movement for climate change or movement for nuclear disarmament. Specifically in America, we seem to be maybe some of the most pessimistic about this. So maybe you could go into a bit of the original impetus of the American idea to give up this nuclear technology and internationalize it in the name of the greater good.
Well, you know, what happened in 1946 when the United States was actually putting on the table a plan that you might think had a chance for success if other nations were willing to accept international control of nuclear development. But the Soviet Union was not willing at that time to do it, and potentially other nations were not willing. But that's not the end of the story, because you might think that we have a solution. We have a solution that was worked out in the 1968 Non-Proliferation Treaty, which, as of 2016, has been signed by 191 nations. One has left, which was North Korea, and four nations never joined this treaty. And for three of them, the reasons are obvious. One is India, the other is Pakistan, the other is Israel, all of whom at the time were developing nuclear weapons, had not gone public with their programs, and were not willing to allow to give up their programs. And South Sudan has never joined. It's a new nation that was set up after the end of the civil war in Sudan. In May 1995, the parties to this treaty agreed to make it something that would extend indefinitely. And the treaty has three pillars that seem to provide us with what might be considered a solution if they were to be followed. The first is a principle of non-proliferation. And what that means is that all the non-nuclear weapon states agree never to acquire nuclear weapons. And at the same time, the nuclear power states, the nuclear weapon states, which at the beginning were basically, as I mentioned, the United States, the Soviet Union, China, the UK, and France, they agreed not to transfer weapons or weapons technology to other states. Now, of course, you might ask, why would the states that do not yet have nuclear weapons agree to continue to be among the have-nots? Well, there was a second pillar of the agreement. And that is that the nations that had recognized nuclear arsenals committed themselves to pursue nuclear disarmament. And Article 6 of this non-proliferation agreement reads as follows. Each party, quote, undertakes to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to cessation of the nuclear arms race at an earlier date and to nuclear disarmament. and on a treaty in general, and complete disarmament under strict and effective control. So in this respect, the nations that do not have nuclear weapons pledge not to develop them in exchange, first, for the nuclear weapon states agreeing to engage in disarmament that will eventually become complete nuclear disarmament. And tied to that was a further pledge on the part of the nuclear weapon states, namely that they would share the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. They would share the benefits of this technology with other nations. Now you can see the interconnection between these different, these three different pillars. I mean, if you did not have non-proliferation, if nations that did not have nuclear weapons did not agree to avoid developing them, then the nations that had nuclear weapons would not really go ahead with disarmament. Because why should they disarm if other nations were now going to be acquiring nuclear weapons? By the same token, why should the have-nots agree to remain without nuclear weapons if those nations that have nuclear weapons are just going to keep them and thereby maintain this gigantic military advantage, which could be used potentially for extortion, threatening, and so forth? You can see that all of these things really had to go together. But, you know, there are certain problems with this agreement. One is that if indeed the nations that have nuclear weapons proceed with disarming and reduce their arsenals gradually, step by step, that in a way gives a greater incentive to other nations to develop a small arsenal. Because if the other nations are winnowing down their arsenals, then they're in a position where they can move quickly to achieve parity and might be tempted to join the nuclear club. On the other hand, there's the whole problem of peaceful uses of atomic energy. And the fact that at that time, before the development of Generation 4 nuclear reactors that need not use uranium, that can be used for nuclear proliferation, the reactors used for peaceful energy purposes did produce uranium, could be used to enrich for uranium, and could be used for nuclear weapons programs. And that was a big problem. And of course, you then had the problem of non-compliance. Iraq had begun its own nuclear weapons program, despite being a signatory. North Korea, of course, did. Romania was doing so. Libya was doing so. Syria was doing so. Although Israeli jets ended up destroying the Syrian reactor that was involved in a program of nuclear weapons research. But in event, where are we? You know, you have an agreement that could be looked upon as a kind of blueprint for complete nuclear disarmament in a way where non-proliferation could be something that would be feasible. But today, the five nuclear weapon states authorized as such in the non-proliferation treaty, they still have 22,000 warheads. You know, although we have eliminated 13,000 of our warheads, eliminated 80% of the deployed strategic warheads, and then 90% of all those relatively small non-strategic warheads, battlefield nuclear weapons deployed by NATO, we still are in a situation where mutually assured destruction remains the order of the day. And we still have a situation where there are nuclear buttons because there is the threat of decapitation. Is there a way out?
Seems not, but I think there's definitely an easy response in saying that there needs to be some sort of abolition. But once again, there's a whole network of issues with that that you've already laid out in talking about the political impossibility of world government and the possibility of a global civil agreement on something like this just doesn't work. Also, of course, there was in the 80s... Reagan figured that there could be a technology that would defend this against, but the calculus apparently was too difficult to actually follow through with. Could you maybe outline some of the other?
Well, in a sense, you know, Reagan introduced a Star Wars proposal, with a certain degree of confidence and faith that, you know, we could develop a technology that would allow us to basically shoot down incoming nuclear weapons coming from ballistic missiles of various sorts, maybe even cruise missiles skimming the Earth's surface. You know, it's not clear that this would help us with suitcase bombs, but that's of a different order of threat than a full-scaled exchange. But the major pitfall of the whole idea of Star Wars is that before we abolish nuclear weapons, we first seek to defend ourselves from them. And the problem is that any kind of defense, it would seem, can be overridden in various ways. By the way, one simple way is by destroying satellites that are the basis of much of our our GPS abilities, our ability to navigate and control our own weapons. And of course, it's possible to destroy satellites fairly easily, especially with nuclear weapons if one wanted to. And various ways of having all sorts of incoming dummy missiles, and it seemed to be a technological task that could always be thwarted, and one was always one step behind the advantage of offensive weaponry. On the other hand, if we could abolish nuclear weapons first, then we could build defenses that would be a hedge against the cheaters. Because the cheaters would not yet be in a position to be developing a full panoply of offensive weapons that could get through defenses. So in a way, if it were possible to first have an abolition to which we could then add some kind of defenses, these defenses might have a chance to be effective. But that's different from the Reagan Star Wars proposal. It requires first that we have an abolition. Now, can we have an abolition? Can we have an abolition without having world government? Without having an effective, world authority that will enforce and have the power to enforce compliance with treaty decisions regarding non-proliferation and nuclear armament? Well, Jonathan Schell put forward a proposal for an abolition that he thought would solve this problem, where you were not stuck with this insoluble quandary of not being able to abolish nuclear weapons without world government and not being in a position to have world government. But there was another way of doing it. And what he proposed is that we have an abolition agreement that has the following provisions to it. First of all, the nuclear powers are going to commit themselves to actually getting rid of all their nuclear weapons. And other nations that don't yet have nuclear weapons would agree to a strengthened non-proliferation agreement with various kinds of inspection and the like. In addition, there would have to be a limiting and balancing of conventional forces, which would be primarily armed and deployed in a defensive mode. Now, you might ask, why do we have to have, together with a proposal to abolish nuclear weapons, a way of limiting and balancing conventional forces? Which means, in other words, we do not allow any nation to have conventional superiority. We have a balance of powers in the remaining conventional weaponry. You know, why? Well, you know, we've seen that if a nation like ourselves is so far outspending other nations that we have a conventional superiority, that puts pressure on other nations to go nuclear and defend themselves, because they cannot really defend themselves with conventional arms. So in a way, if we're going to work towards abolition, we have to have also a balance in conventional arms. And we also have to allow for anti-nuclear forces, just in case people are cheating, just in case inspection cannot be totally accurate. And the key to the proposal that Shell puts forward is the idea that nations would be permitted to be in a certain kind of defined readiness to rearm themselves with nuclear weapons. Now, that might appear to be strange. You know, why would you want the parties to an abolition agreement to be in a situation where they would have at their disposal resources which would enable them to rearm with nuclear weapons within a certain period of time? Not a very short time, but a time that would be short enough to be able to, in a sense, face up and oppose any nation that went rogue and started to develop nuclear weapons again. After all, we can't eliminate the knowledge of how to build nuclear weapons. That is there, and it provides the potential for any nation to go nuclear. But in a way, it also provides us with something that could provide a stability to an abolition agreement. Namely, if all nations know that if they go rogue, violate the terms of the agreement, and go forward with developing a nuclear arsenal, they're going to be met by other nations that are going to be capable of doing the same. And that will allow for there to be a kind of deterrence without nuclear weapons. The deterrence comes from having the capability to reinstitute an arsenal. But that presents a kind of deterrence that is not a mutual assured destruction deterrence. It's a deterrence that is still there when the weapons have been abolished. It's still there because the knowledge of how to design nuclear weaponry and build them and engineer them does not disappear from the planet. And that the resources to reestablish a nuclear arsenal are also available. Available sufficiently so there is a kind of mutual deterrence among the parties to this agreement. Shell speaks about it as a kind of weaponless deterrence effect, where today, under mutually assured destruction, you know, what is the lead time we have before we face nuclear annihilation at the hands of our enemies? It could be as little as 7 minutes. We can have an agreement where we establish a situation where nations would be able to rearm, but not within such a short period. It would take them enough time that other nations can meet that challenge if need be, as well as perhaps take action. Now, of course, Shell's proposal has not been taken up, but it's something to think about. And one thing that might help us think about it as not being completely unrealistic is how nations have behaved when they have had nuclear weapons. Because there are three examples where nations have had nuclear weapons, have had nuclear weapon superiority, but have chosen not to do anything with it. The prime example, of course, is the United States and how we behaved between 1945 and 1949 when we had a nuclear monopoly. What did we do with it? We didn't do anything with it in terms of extorting other nations. Instead, we tried to move towards a kind of disarmament proposal that did not succeed. The Soviet Union also had a tremendous nuclear superiority vis-a-vis China between the mid-50s to the 1980s, so that even when the Chinese developed their small nuclear arsenal, the Soviet Union had a first strike capability to obliterate all the nuclear weapons of China. And they could have used it if they really wanted to make use of their nuclear edge to dominate China, but they did not do it. They did not do it. They didn't do it under Stalin. They didn't do it under Khrushchev or Brezhnev. And a third example is the war between Britain and Argentina over the Falklands. You know, Britain was a nuclear power. Argentina was not. Britain did not use nuclear weapons. You know, it's not just the fear of retaliation which holds nations back from nuclear destruction, and which might allow us to think of the possibility of moving in the direction of nuclear disarmament. I mean, certainly we need to move as quickly as possible to a situation where we can reduce our arsenals, and particularly the arsenals of the United States and Russia, to the point where we have no need of worrying about a decapitation strike, or we have no need to worry about a first strike that could wipe out enough of our arsenal for the other side to be able to feel that it could go ahead and do this to its advantage. I mean, and we also need to really reduce the number of nuclear weapons below the threshold for any nuclear exchange producing a depletion of the ozone or a nuclear winter, which would not just reverse climate change, but do it to such a degree where it wipes out humanity in short order. You know, we could say to have a worldwide ethical obligation to proceed to that degree of relative disarmament. And admittedly, there are these objections between those nations that don't have nuclear weapons, and certainly they have reason to think that we don't want the haves to be able to retain their relative nuclear monopoly. But it's certainly in the world's interest that we first reduce things so that we escape global nuclear annihilation, and then move as fast as we can to prevent nuclear proliferation, move towards an abolition that could potentially make use of the weaponless deterrence of which Jonathan Schell had spoken when he wrote his book on abolition almost 25 years ago. You know, we have to realize that this is something where our national security is very much tied to global security, because we're here talking about the security of nations, where when they feel insecure, that is an incentive for them to arm themselves with weaponry that will put us into a situation of dire insecurity. And nuclear armaments currently are the weapons that are in existence that put humanity under its gravest nation, under its gravest threat. And we have to think about not allowing that to continue, despite contending with the pandemic, and despite also contending with climate change. We can't forget about the threat of nuclear disarmament, of nuclear annihilation, and take seriously the challenge of working out nuclear disarmament.
And I think it's important you note that there's so much more to this question of nuclear disarmament than the notion of deterrence in general. People don't want to be known as the nation that set off a nuclear bomb. And I imagine today that's even more prevalent than some of these previous examples. One thing that I always sort of come back to when it's when the talk about nuclear disarmament and such happen, there's a often forgotten Jimmy Carter policy of love, a foreign policy of love. And I think, you know, no matter how sort of relatively unsuccessful he might have been at achieving this, there's something to be said about thinking about security in its essence as hopefully a loving act.
But, well, I think that's also a way of thinking about how if we are going to really be secure, we have to make other nations feel secure. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we have to like their regimes. That doesn't mean that we are going to avoid putting what kinds of pressure we can to prevent grave injustices. But we have to recognize that there's a degree of threats that can be very counterproductive to every nation's security. And of course, when we're talking about regime change, right, the idea of regime change has many pitfalls associated with it. You know, we can topple regimes, that are oppressive. But we can't unilaterally bring the liberated people to participate in institutions of freedom. They have to engage in that on their own. We cannot compel them to. Now, we have had success historically in overthrowing dangerous oppressive regimes, such as the Nazi regime in Germany, the imperial regime in Japan. And under our occupation, there was a very quick and remarkable transition to democratic nations that were more liberated, in the case of Germany and Japan, than those nations had ever been. But we also have to recognize that regime change can have other outcomes, where the liberation from oppression does not follow with the building of democratic institutions, and where the threat of regime change can also involve nuclear proliferation. Now, we're in a world in which these negative possibilities of proliferation and a new arms race are very much in the offing. By withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, Iran may very well decide to engage in developing nuclear weapons. And if it does so, I think it's very likely that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are going to do the same in order to balance themselves against the Shiite threat of Iran. And there unfortunately is a new arms race that the Trump administration seems to be promoting, and perhaps to some degree the Putin regime and China to some degree, where all of these nations are modernizing their nuclear weapon arsenals, are developing hypersonic weapons that provide a different delivery system that will even be quicker than ballistic missiles. And then there is a move to militarize space. Trump has set up a space corps. China has exploded satellites, testing anti-satellite technology, military technology. All of these things can be very destabilizing because of the role of communication satellites with regard to terrestrial military. So I think we have to recognize that we do not want to be at a tipping point where a new arms race is going to burst forth and nuclear proliferation will get completely out of hand. Now is the time to take action. And we need to think hard about the possible routes that can be followed and not think about nuclear disarmament as a completely utopian dream.